fighting fatigue, ladies and gentlemen. Up all night last night. Flew out to Wyoming after the program yesterday for, say, just a social dinner with some friends. And because of my sense of duty and service, to not only you in this program, but to myself as well, I flew back right after dinner and I rolled in about 5 o'clock and decided to punt going to bed because I've had 2 hours sleep and I'm wasted. Better to stay up. So I started working on show prep and so forth and so on. And I just issue this as a warning when I'm doing the program in this state of fatigue. And you probably wouldn't know it if I didn't tell you. Such is my level of professionalism. Level of professionalism, but still I'm giddy in situations like this. We sometimes get real near the edge. So we've expanded our on-air broadcast delay today to 40 seconds from the usual 7, just as a precaution. Telephone number 800-282-2882 if you want to be on the program today. The email address rush@eibnet.com. One more thing on this Michael Vick situation. I think, you know, everybody's focused on the dogs and the cruel, sadistic, tortuous treatment of the dogs, and that's bad enough. And that's going to be very difficult for Vic to overcome with the public in terms of his image. I'm reading some of these drive-by holier-than-thou columnists who say the first thing he's going to have to do is send a big check to the ASPCA and a big check to the Humane Society and become a spokesman for it. Oh, come on! Who's going to buy that? I know we're a forgiving country. That's not the big deal. As far as the league is concerned, the NFL is concerned, what I think their big concern is, who are these guys that Vic was running with? And if he was the ringleader of this, who are these? This is a bunch of human debris he's running around with. And there's gambling going on here. And if there's gambling going on here, was there gambling going on other things where Vic was involved? And I guarantee you, you know, they've got this independent counsel now, the new commissioner, who is a new sheriff in town. This guy is suspended Adam Pac-Man Jones for a full season. He hadn't even found guilty of anything yet. But, you know, two letters for you, OJ. Everybody knows. But nevertheless, this guy is, and this judge in the Vic case is a hanging judge, apparently. This guy goes for the upper limit of the sentencing guidelines. And although we don't know what's in the pleading, what he's going to admit to in his plea agreement on Monday, they're saying that the sentencing guidelines here are 12 to 18 months, and this judge can go beyond that if he wants to. So we'll see. But as far as the league is concerned and the Atlanta Falcons, it's going to be, what else was going on here? And who are these people that Vic was running around with? And how come we didn't know about this? And this is going to lead to a lot of scrutiny, more scrutiny on even more NFL players. So this, it's going to be interesting to watch the fallout from this. All right, Michelle Obama, let's get to this, because I said, you know, mentioned in the previous hour, the gloves have come off, Elizabeth Edwards and Michelle Obama going after Hillary, because their husbands really can't. In our culture today, you just can't go after the girl. I don't care. Rick Lazio, he didn't even go after her, just left his podium in a debate during a Senate race campaign, went over, presented her a piece of paper on eliminating some kind of fundraising. And the drive-bys went nuts with the fact that he invaded her space. Why, that's cruel. It was threatening. Yeah, threatening and all those kind of things. So Obama and the Breck girl have realized, even though the Breck girl is more of a woman than Mrs. Clinton, in his own words, has passed off the assault duties, if you will, the verbal assault duties to his wife. Michelle Obama got in a game recently. She, among other things, she's out there saying that if you can't run your own house, you're not qualified to run the White House. Now, we all know what that is an allusion to. But we have even more from Michelle Obama. This is last Friday in Council Bluffs, Iowa, a portion of her introduction of her husband, Barack Hussein Obama.
Fear of everything. Fear that we might lose. Fear that he might get hurt. Fear that this would be ugly. Fear that it would hurt our family. Fear. But you know, the reason why I said yes was because I am tired of being afraid.
So am I.
I am tired of living in a country where every decision that we made over the last 10 years wasn't for something, but it was because people told us we had to fear something. We had to fear people who looked different from us.
Who?
Fear people who believed in things that were different from us. Fear of one another right here in our own backyards. I am so tired of fear, and I don't want my girls to live in a country, in a world based on fear.
Now, a lot of people have had what I think is a predictable reaction to this. Mine is a little different. I happen to agree with her. In this sense, from our perspective, do you know how impatient and tired I'm getting at dealing with people on our side who are afraid of Hillary? I can't stand it. There's no reason to. I mean, the time to fear Hillary is after she wins. Right now, it's time to prevent that. And you don't do that out of fear. I mean, fear can be a motivator at times, but it can also corrupt you. Because it can make you end up feeling inferior. It can make you tell yourself stories, in this case, of her inevitability, of the fact that she's unbeatable, blah, 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 blah. And that creates its own mindset, which cements defeat. I'm sorry, this is not the time for that. And I don't think Michelle Obama is necessarily talking about that. She's got other things on her mind. But she still has a point, even though she may not know it. Here's the second bite. Then this one she aims straight at for Hillary.
Please, please don't base your votes this time on fear. Base it on possibility. Think. Listen. The game of politics is to make you afraid so that you don't think. We need leadership. We need people with judgment. We need decent people, people with common sense, people with strong family values, people who understand the world. We need a man like Barack Obama who you know on the day that he is elected to office will change the way the world sees us. You know that. That is the possibility of Barack Obama.
Now, keep in mind what's happening here. This is a Democrat primary campaign. When she makes that reference here, we need people with common sense, strong family values, people who understand the world, that's aimed right at Hillary Clinton and also her husband, Bill. It's aimed right at them. Now, one more thing about fear. I don't mind people being afraid of me. I like that. I don't mind people fearing our country on the battlefield. That's good. More people should. And believe me, they do, despite what the Democrats say. So, you know, fear is a two-way street. You just don't want to hit the sign that says one way, do not enter. And that's what the Democrats offer. Now, let's go to Barack Obama himself. He has an op-ed I found in the Miami Herald. And basically, he's calling for the end of the Cuban embargo. And listen to what he writes. It is a tragedy that just 90 miles from our shores, there exists a society where such freedom and opportunity are kept out of reach by a government that clings to discredited ideology and authoritarian control. Now, I read that and I said, is he describing Cuba or America in his view? Because the liberals love Cuba. They love Castro. They got the best healthcare system in the world. They go down there and they break bread and they make buddies with Castro. Now, Obama hasn't done it. But how's this going to play? I thought Cuba was a perfect place for liberals. The Hollywood left loves him and loves the place. Michael Moore thinks it's the best healthcare in the world. Well, hell, so does Charlie Rangel, for that matter. A lot of people do, say they do. Anyway, he writes here, a democratic opening in Cuba is and should be the foremost objective of our policy. We need a clear strategy to achieve it, one that takes some limited steps now to spread the message of freedom on the island but preserves our ability to bargain on behalf of democracy with a post-Fidel government. See, there's always these, we need to do this, but. We need to do this while. We need to do, always a qualifier here. To make sure he doesn't offend anybody. Remember, this is in the Miami Herald, where the exile community down there is not going to want to hear this. not going to want to read this. They don't want, well, they'd love Cuba opened up, but not with any remnants of the Castro regime remaining. Back to the phones right after this. Sit tight. I knew that. I knew it was time to rejoin the content portion of the program. Rush Limbaugh behind the golden EIB microphone here at the Limbaugh Institute. Now to the phones. This is Robert in Miami, an airline pilot. Welcome, sir. Great to have you on the air.
Rush, from all of us at Fly the North Atlantic, up all night, fatigue dittos to you, my friend.
Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate that.
Well, listen, I just wanted to dispel fear as well, and that may be the fear that many of the millions across the fruited plain may have felt when you said that if a commercial aircraft lost its engines in flight, it would fall down. It would not, Rush. It would glide 3 miles for every 1,000 feet of altitude and would give those flying it a fighting chance to put it down safely. And I, too, am amazed at the feats of endeavor, but I just wanted to let you know that because even your critics claim that you're 95% accurate, but when you're not due to fatigue, those of us that love you run to the rescue.
Well, I appreciate it, but once again, this will not impact the audit rating because this was I was wrong on a matter of fact as opposed, this is not an opinion, and it's only my opinions that are audited. But I must confess, I've not heard of this happening except when people told me about the 767 up in Canada.
You know, I'm not familiar with that one, Rush, but whether you're flying in a commercial aircraft or a luxury craft like EIB-1, the wings are what make the thing fly, and whether it's being powered or not, it's still going to fly. It just may not reach its destination.
No, I understand. I understand the principle of aerodynamics. Some people erroneously call it lift. It's actually a difference in air pressure, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. It's a portion of lift. That's right.
Right. Now, the reason that I made the statement is I've never heard it happening. And that's why I hadn't heard of this Boeing 767 thing. And there are, you know, with an airplane that well, you hate talking about this stuff, but there are airline crashes. These things happen. And why, if they're able to glide?
Well, the reason why, right, there's a multitude of reasons why. Usually it's a chain of events that lead to an accident. But in the case of, saying having a power failure completely in flight, that aircraft is going to continue to glide because the wings are creating lift. And it's going to glide about 3 miles for every 1,000 feet of altitude it has. So if you're cruising along like you were last night at 35,000 feet.
Nope, 50.
50. Right? Well, I forgot about that. You can fly higher than I can.
51.
At 51,000 feet, you would glide at least 150 miles looking for a place to land. I, of course, cannot get to those flight levels, so I compliment you, sir.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Rush.
Thanks very much. That is a comforting phone call. And I, you know, speaking of Michelle Obama's fear, I probably did instill fear in a lot of people's hearts and minds when I made the carelessly reckless statement that commercial airliner could not glide as the shuttle does. The shuttle has a worse glide ratio than a commercial airliner would. There's no question. I mean, that thing, it's like 9 to 1, the glide ratio. It's a rock. It's what amazes me about there. Bring that thing down from 200 plus miles to a 20,000 foot target, basically a 4 mile target. This is Norm in Pinon Hills. Am I pronouncing that right? California?
Yeah, Pinon Hills.
Right. Pinon Hills. That's a Snurdly's fault. Forgot to put the I in there. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for the call, sir.
Well, thank you. Listen, you got to take back that apology that you gave to Mr. Young, the union thug.
Yeah.
The gal in Sarasota, she got it right. She just probably generalized too much, saying they're stupid. The union does depend on people to be politically ignorant.
No, I said they're stupid. Well, I forget who said they're stupid. I think we both did.
I said
that the union thinks, based on what she told me,
right,
that the letter carrier members are stupid if they think they're going to not notice that there were no Republicans. He said the Republicans didn't react to the offer to put position statements in their magazine.
Well, you ought to fire off a letter requesting the postal record that they put out in September and October of the last election cycle and the 2004 election. And you'll see exactly, and these aren't people who are running. These are people who the union is recommending to vote for.
Yeah.
And you'd be hard-pressed to find a Republican in there. If there's one. And I'm talking state, national. They tell you all the way around who they're supporting. And financial records. How about who they're giving their money to?
We know that. I mean, that the unions are...
So for him to sit there and say that, oh, they're giving him an opportunity, he's just blowing smoke.
Well, let me read the last paragraph of his letter to me in which he asked for an apology. He said, the fact is we are a democratic union. Our members will guide which candidate to support for president. What does that mean? Our members will guide which candidate. What
it means the ones who go along with the union mantra are going to vote for whoever the union recommends.
What he's saying is the members will do that, not the thug leadership. He's saying the members will guide which candidate to support for president.
The members don't write the postal record. They receive it.
Yeah. Okay, and he says, but I don't know how Republican candidates expect to win the support of hardworking letter carriers when they lack the courtesy to respond to a simple issue survey. Not all Republicans show such a lack of respect, but far too many do.
Well, he's got a snapshot in time. Go back to, you can go back the last 20 years, who they're recommending in their postal record.
I understand, but in the context of his complaint, and we're talking about William Young, the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. We got this call from a woman in Sarasota, and she said that there were no Republicans in this particular issue, giving their issue statements, and it was under her, she was under the impression, probably because of the way the union does lean, that the Republicans weren't given a chance. Mr. Young said, well, yes, they were, they just didn't respond.
Well, how come?
So that, I mean, you can't, he's not going to write me a letter say that's not true and have me read it on the radio.
No, exactly. And that's what I'd say.
Okay, so the question is, why didn't the Republicans respond, do you think? Waste of time?
Probably. They probably didn't think they'd get in there. Who edits the thing? How do you know they didn't?
It's a good point. How do we know they didn't? You know, what about this, Norm? What about maybe the Republicans did respond and their responses just got lost in the mail?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, it happens.
All right. I appreciate Thanks, Norm, for the call. Appreciate it. Richard and we're going nuts. Kurt in Arcadia, Florida. You're next, sir, on the EIB network. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
My name is Kurt.
Yeah.
From Arcadia.
Yeah, I know. I just introduced you to the audience.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Wasn't aware I was already on the air.
You've been on the air here about 30 seconds.
Oh, sorry, sir. I was just calling in reference to the gentleman last hour, the Democrat with the big D. He said he couldn't understand why we were still in Iraq for so long.
Right.
And I just came back from Iraq back in October. And I can tell you one of the reasons, actually two reasons, why I think is taking so long to get out of Iraq. The soldiers over there are also not only soldiers, but we're playing correctional officers and police officers over there. And one of the reasons is the language barrier. Where people like me are training the Iraqis over there.
Yeah, but that may have been the case. But what I'm reading is that the tribal leaders, we've broken the language barrier in a number of these areas where the surge is taking place. They're joining our side because they're sick and tired of what the brutality they see from Al-Qaeda. And I'll tell you something else. You know what I think another problem with why this has taken so long? We've got a major political party in this country for the last 4 years has been trying to engineer defeat and demoralize the members of the military. You can't take that out of this equation. Just got a flash email here from our official climatologist at the EIB network, Roy Spencer, University of Alabama in Huntsville. He became curious, as a good scientist is, over our discussion of what essentially would be a dead stick landing. You got a commercial airline that loses power. It's called a dead stick landing. He says, I remember this from the newspaper, Rush, on May 24th, 1988. A new 737 jet coming from Caribbean superpower Belize had its engines quenched in a hailstorm, and it made the first dead stick landing of a commercial jet ever. And he gave me the link for this, airspacemag.com. Well, I call it Caribbean superpower. You go back to the Gulf War, they were one of our allies. They sent... I think they sent a couple of guns. I'm not sure. And I just jokingly referred to them as the Caribbean superpower Belize. Because frankly, until the Gulf War, I had never heard of it. And they were being trumpeted as one of our good allies. I was happy to know that. Try this story. This in Port Orange, Florida, police have arrested two men on charges of murder nearly 4 months after Officials pulled a New York woman's decapitated head from a canal in Alligator Alley down here in Florida. Basically, that's the highway that goes from Fort Lauderdale over to Naples. Paul Brian Trucchio, 33, and Robert Mackey, 39, have been charged with grand theft and first-degree murder in the death of Lorraine Hatzikorian. Or Hatzikorian, I'm sorry, a 41-year-old New York woman who disappeared in April. Now, according to the incident report, Hatzikorian left New York with both men in her pickup truck. At some point, there was a disagreement. It appeared that she was bound, beaten unconscious, then dismembered, with the suspects allegedly disposing of her body parts as they made their way to Florida. Both these clowns were arrested on Saturday. This ends a nearly four-month investigation that began in April when Hatzikorian's head was found in a canal in western Broward County, a plastic grocery bag from Waldbaum's, a supermarket chain located only in New York, led police north. You know, it's a good thing that this idiotic trend to get rid of plastic grocery bags in San Francisco has not swept New York yet, or they may never have solved the crime. Okay, Richard, Beaumont, Texas, you're next. Welcome, sir, to the EIB Network.
Thank you very much, Russ. It's sure good to talk to you.
You bet, sir.
Okay, I just want to thank Mr. Young for getting us another contract.
Okay, wait. Hang on just a second. I need you to slow down here so I can understand. You want to thank Mr. Young for what?
Another contract. Well, he just negotiated another contract.
William Young. We're back to the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers here.
Right.
He just negotiated another contract for you. Are you a letter carrier?
Yes, I am.
Okay, he just negotiated, and you want to thank him for that?
Yes, I thank him for that. But also, I want to let you know that I don't agree with his politics or the union's politics.
Well, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to vote on the right side.
Yeah, but you're going to tell any? Well, you just did tell us. You're a brave guy.
So I've just told you that. I've been in the union for about 11 years. I don't vote the way they recommend us to vote.
Well, so long as it stays a recommendation, you're safe.
Right. And so, that's just what I wanted to say.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it, Richard. Thanks very much. But, Richard, are you still there?
Yes.
Are you being serious when you wanted to thank him, when you thanked him for negotiating the contract?
Yes, I was.
It's a good contract?
It's a good contract. Normally, we go to binding arbitration. But this time we didn't have to go to binding arbitration. They negotiated a good contract.
Great. That means taxpayers get screwed again. Well, congratulations.
Oh, no.
Thanks. You're getting Thanks, Richard. Steve in Miami, you're next on the EIB Network. Well, who pays the letter carriers?
Hello.
Yeah, Steve, welcome.
Hi, Rush. How are you?
Hi, good.
Good. A few days ago, you talked about a baseball study that showed bias, and you said there was a flaw in the study.
Yeah.
There really isn't. Isn't necessarily a flaw. You can tell just by looking at a large number of pitches, like they were about 2 million pitches. All you have to do is see what the average of balls and strikes are. Let's say it's 50-50. And then if you get a black ump with a white batter or vice versa, if you see that it differs statistically from the norm, you can see a bias.
Okay, let's set the table here so that people know what we're talking about, because this this is last week, I think. Some researchers, was this University of Texas?
Oh, I don't remember.
I think it was. I'm not sure. But they did. They studied over 2 million pitches in Major League Baseball. And they concluded that there is racial bias, not intentional, but racial bias when a pitcher and umpire are of differing races. A white ump will favor a white pitcher with more strike calls, and a black ump will favor a black or Hispanic pitcher with more strike calls. And what I said was, it seems to me that you would have to be able to know what every pitch actually was.
But you don't, because all you have to do is know what the average is.
Okay, so you average...
Well, if you know the average is, let's say, 50-50, but when a black pitcher gets up there at 60% strikes...
Hold on. I'm like a woman when you get to numbers. I don't follow them too easily. What? 50-50 what?
Let's say 50% strikes and 50% balls.
Okay.
Overall average for all pitchers, batters, umps.
Gotcha. I'm with you so far.
And then you get, let's say, a black pitcher up there and a white ump, and there's a greater percentage called of balls, statistically significant greater percentage, you can see a bias.
Aha! So it's a statistical bias. They're not making some actual claim here.
Right. I mean, it would be almost impossible to do that.
Well, that was my point.
Right. Since but you can see statistically if there is a difference.
Yeah, I guess you could. All right. Well, I stand corrected. Until okay, somebody else calls and tells me you were wrong.
And gauche happens to be French for left, so.
Yes. Well, you've been waiting for a whole week.
I have. You know what? I don't listen to you so often. I'm driving in my car sometimes on the way to or from appointments. That's when I get a chance to listen to you. It's hard to catch you, hard to get in, so I just thought I'd make
a couple points. I appreciate you making it. Thanks much.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Now, what brought that? We had a call. So I was asking some guy what some words mean. I was using some words one day that were a little bit esoteric and off the beaten path. And I asked the guy what gauche meant, and he got it half right. But I didn't correct him. I was not trying to laud my vocabulary skills over anybody. But this guy remembers the call, gauche, which is really inappropriate, just goofy, ill-mannered behavior is rooted. It's a French word. And it means left, because in the old days in France, left-handers were thought to be goofy, odd, outcast, this kind of thing. Well, outcast is the wrong word, but it was improper. Something that was improper. It indicated poor potty training in the formative years, they thought. And so that's where the word comes from. It is French, and it does mean it has its roots in left, as in left-handedness. Joe in Dearborn Heights, Michigan, welcome to the EIB Network.
Semper Fi to you, Rush.
Thank you, sir.
I'm a letter carrier. I've been a letter carrier for 38 years. And candidate Bush back in 2000 did submit to the union paper, and he scored second to Al Gore. I think Gore was in the high 20 percentile, and I think President Bush was like 20, close to 20%. And ever since then, there hasn't not been another Republican in our union magazine. I think the union was kind of upset that he scored so well. There's a lot of us conservatives in the postal service.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually thrilled at what's happening here, the way this is all falling out today, because this show's obviously number one in the letter carriers union.
Oh, yes. Well, thanks to you, we've converted several people at our office alone over the last couple elections.
Well, that's fabulous. It's not surprising that Bush would be rated second, though, in this letter of letter carriers that would be rating the responses. I don't know who else would have been there in 2000. There was a third-party candidate early.
Al Gore, and I can't remember the other candidate.
Yeah, but you figure Gore would win in a union publication where the members are rating the responses of the candidates. But
correct.
What you're saying is Bush got pretty close to him.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Scarily close, I guess. Too scary for the union to put another Republican in there, I believe.
It's amazing how many letter carriers today do not believe William Young, the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers. All right, a quick timeout. We'll be back and continue with all the rest of today's exciting excursion into broadcast excellence after this. I don't want to leave this a rock situation until a couple of more things are said. First, a couple sound bites. I want to go back and play audio of me. I don't get to listen to myself much, folks. I mean, you realize you all listen to the number one radio program in America. I never get to, because I am hosting it. And as such, I don't get to hear myself, not the way you do. So I like to go back and play sound bites of me, especially when I predicted something that's come true, as this is. August 9th, on this program, I predicted this. Drive-by media just echoing whatever the Democrat talking points are of the day, or vice versa. This is about Maliki. The drive-bys they're going to try to topple Nouri al-Maliki, the president, premier of Iraq, because, of course, the surge is working. But we have to ignore that now, folks, because the political situation's falling apart. And because the political situation's falling apart, we got to go get Maliki. And lo and behold, Carl Levin, he comes out of Iraq, says, hey, you know what? Surge is working. It's really working. But
the Maliki government is non-functional. So I hope that the Iraqi assembly, when it reconvenes in a few weeks, will vote the Maliki government out of office.
This is unbelievable. Still trying to secure defeat in the midst of victory. Now, what's interesting is in the Washington Post today, there's a story by Jonathan Weissman, and they mention Democrat Representative Baird. We talked about him yesterday. He's the guy, he's the head of the Democrat Steering Committee, the House Democrat Steering Committee. He's in Nancy Pelosi's leadership triumvirate. And last Friday, this is the guy that that told a local newspaper in his district that he believes the U.S. should stay in the country, in Iraq, as long as necessary to ensure stability. A lot of other Democrats are changing their views, too. Jerry McNerney, a Democrat from California, suggested his trip to Iraq made him more flexible in his search for a bipartisan accord on the future U.S. role. If anything, I'm more willing to work to find a way forward, he said. Tim Mahoney, Democrat Florida, who was with McNerney, told his local paper that the troop increase has really made a difference, really has gotten Al-Qaeda on their heels. Durbin basically said we're making some measurable progress there. But some Democrats have shifted their views. This Baird guy said yesterday, and this is what's interesting, he said yesterday that Congress's debate over the war has destabilized Iraq by sending wary Iraqi politicians back to their sectarian bases of support. So this is profound, folks. This is a Democrat in Nancy Pelosi's leadership triumvirate, basically saying that the political situation in Iraq is bad because of the disagreement and the discord that has taken place in the debate in Congress. It's destabilized Iraq. In other words, made them feel not confident that we're in it for the long haul. And so the political leaders are going back to their sectarian base, which means the Sunnis and the Shia, rather than unifying, they're retreating and going back to their bases, or were. And he lays it squarely on the debate going on in Congress, because that's destabilizing, because it's not engendering any confidence. Now, I said among the Iraqis, and I said earlier that one of the reasons this war has taken so long is because of the drive-by media in this country. The Democrats have done everything they can to invest in defeat and own it. And there's a demoralization factor for the U.S. troops. May not be that strong, but I'll tell you what it has done is certainly over this length of time encouraged the enemy. And now we find out that it's destabilizing the Iraqi political situation that Carl Levin wants to solve by kicking Maliki out of office. And that would really destabilize things. These guys are still angling for defeat. Make no mistake about it. Cheryl in Shreveport, Louisiana, you're next on the EIB Network. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
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 I can't believe I'm talking to you about this. There's so many times I wanted to call and couldn't get through, but this is the last thing. You're funny, but you're not always funny. Like your snide remark about women and numbers. Are you trying to lose your women listeners? That was not funny.
I can't imagine anything more ridiculous than me wanting to lose female listeners. I can't believe you would even think that.
Well, why would you joke about something like
that? Because I haven't been to bed all night, and I love stereotypical humor. And it's true. People start throwing numbers around, and you've heard me on this program. I start adding, subtracting things in my head. You know, look at Barbie.
But you just downgraded women.
I had a Barbie doll once, Cheryl, and you pull a string in the back. Math class is tough. You know the stereotype. I was just making a stereotypical joke.
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe you said that. I really can't. I mean, we laugh at you all the time, but that was not funny. That was degrading to some women.
Why? Because it's true?
No, it's not. Maybe it is nowadays, but not to your listeners. We're smart out here.
Yes, I understand this.
Okay.
All right. Well, it was just some stereotypical humor.
Okay. Do you apologize to the women?
Well, you know, Cheryl, I have to tell you that Cheryl is one of my all-time top 10 female names, and I hope that I can salvage your loyalty here as an audience member. But I'm not going to apologize for anything. But people in my position never apologize. But we just acknowledge that you were upset and offended by it. And I'll apologize you were offended.
Okay.
But I'm not going to apologize for saying, because I meant to say it. I mean, why would I apologize for something I meant to say? It was a joke.
Okay. I guess. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
She's laughing. She's laughing.
Well, you are funny most of the time.
Well, admit, you thought that was funny. It just you laughed a little bit, didn't you?
I was laughing at your response. But boy, and I couldn't believe I got through the first try. And your call screener said it was fate.
Yeah, divine intervention, karma, whatever you want to call it.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Cheryl, and have a wonderful summer.
Okay.
Back after this. Stay with us. Folks, you remember that cat, Oscar? They called that cat in the nursing home that sensed when patients were going to die, got up on their bed, and they did die. Oscar has turned up dead. The officials at the nursing home would not reveal the cause of death, but they did acknowledge rumors that the cat was becoming increasingly unpopular among the patients. Well, gee, I wonder why. A cat jumps up on your bed, you die. One knowledgeable source who agreed to speak on the condition of anonymity confirmed increasing animosity toward Oscar the cat, and that a dented bedpan was found near the body of Oscar the cat. I'm sure it jumped up on the bed, and a seasoned citizen not ready to cash it in said, "Get off of the bed, Oscar."